This program, brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com, is suitable for mature audiences only and may contain explicit sexual information.
This interview was recorded at the One Taste Center in San Francisco on May 13, 2008.
Welcome to A Taste of Sex, guest speaker interviews, coming to you from the One Taste Urban Retreat Center in San Francisco. I am your host, Harmony Niles. For those of you new to the show, One Taste is an organization committed to developing awareness in all of those areas of our being where we've shut down. We offer workshops and practices designed to bring more connection to your life. And every Tuesday night, we bring in a guest educator to share their perspectives in a fun and interactive way. You can join us live at 1074 Folsom Street in the South of Market neighborhood of San Francisco. Tonight we have Eric Shaw speaking about the tantric roots of yoga. Eric is a doctoral candidate in Hindu religion and philosophy and has over 20 years' experience in meditation and movement. And he teaches yoga here in the city.
There's ways in which that push from a kind of populist perspective to express oneself in the body has a mirror in the practices that came into yoga through Tantra. Tantra was interested in engaging transgressive acts, drinking wine, eating meat, this is for Hindu culture, sexual practices, eating what they called parched grains, mudra, it was seen as addictive, which if you think about it, carbohydrates are kind of addictive. There were these taboo things, and they used those taboo things as a vehicle towards the divine.
Eric, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
So tell me about your talk tonight, The Tantric Roots of Yoga.
The Tantric Roots of Yoga. What intrigues me in my studies is the relationship between yoga's forms and how they come out of cultural conditions or tendencies in culture. So when I look at the tantric roots of yoga, what I'm looking at are a set of homologies, we might say, polarities within Hindu culture, which produced a variety of forms, many of which we see mirrored in popular culture in America, and eventually ripened into the mature forms of Hatha Yoga.
How do you see the rise in the popularity of yoga and like the total embracement of yoga by popular culture? Is Tantra close behind?
Close behind, interesting question. Tantra has definitely been coming into our culture since maybe the early 1900s. There were people who translated tantric texts and attempted to kind of present Tantra in a way that was acceptable to Victorian culture in the 1800s, which was kind of a difficult task, as you might imagine. But culture has sort of turned in its taste, and now we look at Tantra through new cultural eyes, and it looks much more attractive. Both views distort what the original Tantra is. But aside from that, you have what's happening now, which is called generally is called Neo-Tantra rising, which is not related to Hindu cultural forms or the kind of guru pamparam relationship. It's not related to a lineage of guru practices that come out of India. They're kind of neophyte forms that people are kind of in dialogue with suggestions from Hindu culture, but they're kind of recreating them on their own with different forms and maybe different aims. Hatha Yoga I see as taking a similar route, which is might be a little surprising at first. In the late 1800s, Hatha Yoga was looked on very much the same way that Tantra was looked upon. It was sort of looked down on. It was kind of a negative epithet to be called a yogi. The Theosophists, who were the sort of a first group to really begin dialogue between India cultural forms and American cultural forms, Western cultural forms, were accused of being yogis, and that was something that they kind of ran from that label. And even in this country, it took quite a while for yoga to have the kind of appeal it has today. In the 20s, it was looked down on. In the 30s, it was looked down on. And when you get to the 50s, and you get beat culture, and you get these forms of populist culture starting to arise and assert themselves, at that same time, you get the popularity of yoga. A physical practice, a practice concerned with certain forms of power that are not what we might call, I don't know, aristocratic power or highbrow power. It's power that comes from individualized practice, that comes from forms that are artistic, forms that are rooted in spontaneity, forms that are rooted in energy rather than refinement, we might say. And these are a little tricky because there's always kind of messy edges around these words, but that's kind of how I'm casting it. It's the way I'm looking at it.
Was it changes in American culture that made us ready to embrace this now?
Yeah, I definitely believe that. What we saw in the 50s and 60s was we saw the rise of mass media. And what mass media did is it created advertising culture, and it created populist culture. It gave populist culture momentum that it never had before, we might say. Populist culture always had a certain amount of momentum. They were always like, you know, village performers, and then even in the first age of newspapers and when popular culture started to generate new forms, you had circus, you had vaudeville, and that sort of thing. But with television, all of a sudden, art became threaded into people's lives in a deeper way. That had already started to happen with movies and whatnot. So people became kind of cultural junkies for the first time in any culture's history. I mean, it was always nice to sing. It was always nice to do the kinds of artistic things that any culture did, but we became consumers of culture in a way that we never had before. Along with that, everybody's aware of that famous statement by the director of the FCC in the early 1960s that TV was a vast wasteland. Along with that, I think there was a certain taste developed that was broad-based for certain styles of culture that were not highbrow culture, and so you had this mass movement in that way, and this towards this kind of energetic direction in cultural forms rather than a refinement in cultural forms. And I'm looking at that as a polarity: energy on the one side, refinement on the other side. You also had a departure from mass forms of religious practice and mass forms of meaning making through religious practice, and that began to open up religious practice. And this has happened, you know, through history again and again and again. With the 60s, it happened big time. We had all these New Age practices coming in, and the ferment that had been created in the 1890s with Swami Vivekananda coming to America was kind of really strongly coming to a head, and the ground was prepared, you could say, for the coming in of gurus from India to speak to people who had been acculturated in a new way.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Listen to A Taste of Sex, erotic poetry reading, a companion program to life in an orgasm-based community. It's open mic night at One Taste San Francisco, a weekly audio program on personallifemedia.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to A Taste of Sex, guest speaker interviews. We're here with yoga and tantra educator Eric Shah. Eric, do you consider yourself a tantra educator?
Interesting non-diplume.
Yeah.
Tonight, that's what I am.
Awesome.
Yoga educator, perhaps more exactly.
Tell me how you came to this path.
How did I come to the path of yoga? Or did I come to the path of speaking about tantra and yoga? Or,
yeah.
All of that, I suppose. I was raised in a pretty religious home, and so I always kind of had a penchant for religious practice and spiritual practice in various ways. You know, I rebelled against it, I embraced it, rebelled. I've always been involved in work in my body. I've practiced martial arts and done a lot of athletic practice. At the end of a long period of doing triathlon, when I was really pushing my body quite a lot, I had this little voice in my head that was saying, do yoga, do yoga, do yoga. And at some point I gave into it. And I tend to be kind of a gestalt type person. When I do something, I do it completely. So almost immediately I started practicing yoga every day. And I, at the time, I was making a big shift in my life. I was starting to explore dance a lot and teach dance. And I was making new forms of kind of self-examination practice from some work I'd done in kind of group process. And then at some point, about a year after I started practicing yoga very religiously, I just had this other light bulb go on in my head, and I said, Eric, yoga gives you everything that you want. It has everything in it that you want to offer to people. Why not just focus on yoga? So that was about 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago, and it's been pretty much a gestalt since then, pretty pure focus.
And what brought you to the studies of Hindu religion?
That kind of followed in turn, because yoga is rooted in Hindu religion. And I've always been a scholar. I spend my days collecting degrees. So then at some point I was teaching in college, and I wasn't in tenure track because I didn't have a PhD. So I said, Eric, you know, you need to get a PhD. And why not thread that with my interest in yoga? Mm-hmm. So that's what I did.
How do you feel that your studies have changed your life?
How have my studies changed my life? Wow, that's a pretty major question. Well, my life revolves a lot around my yoga teaching, and there's a way in which what I study enriches that. I start to see the kind of multi-level experience through time of what I'm teaching in this moment. I see how it echoes previous forms of yoga practice, previous ideas about yoga, previous intents in yoga, previous forms in yoga. And, you know, I hope that I can offer that to my students. Sometimes I feel like I dwell in a very different place from the people around me because my studies so much focus on different cultures and what has gone on in the past. So I feel like I see everything through a lens that, you know, is echoing former cultural forms. So in that way, it's changed my life even more. I'm more kind of in this kind of, I feel like I'm living in a number of centuries at once rather than just living in the here and now.
What else do you wish I had asked you?
And what else do you wish you'd asked me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I could talk about a little bit about the specifics that I'm recognizing in the relationships between Tantra and yoga, and they're kind of intriguing. If we were doing the imagistic part of my talk, I have a rash of images that I show in this lecture. What I would be showing you were pictures of sadhus and their various practices, and then I would be pairing them with modern day practices. Some of them are the more extreme forms of yoga practice, but still they're quite interesting. One of the slides that I pop up pretty early on the screen is a picture of a breakdancer, and he's upside down, he's got his legs in the air, and he's doing something very much like a Hindu sadhu. So going back to, you know, how I kind of started out introducing this topic, there's ways in which that push from a kind of populist perspective to express oneself in the body has a mirror in the practices that came into yoga through Tantra. Tantra was interested in engaging transgressive acts, drinking wine, eating meat, this is for Hindu culture, sexual practices, eating what they called parched grains, mudra, it was seen as addictive, which if you think about it, carbohydrates are kind of addictive. There were these taboo things, and they use those taboo things as a vehicle towards the divine. So I look at some of the other elements of sadhu practice. You have what's called the digambaras, the wandering sadhus who don't wear clothes. Yeah, they wander naked through the cremation grounds and just through the streets and that sort of thing. And then you have this modern development of naked yoga, which we could say comes from a sensual drive, or you could say it's echoing a kind of natural kind of attitude towards physical practice. You had the Greeks who ran the Olympics in the nude. You had the elements of pagan culture who did rituals in the nude. So there's been this kind of relationship in low field culture between the body and religious practice. So you see that echoed in Hatha Yoga. Hatha Yoga itself means force or sun moon, but force it is developing the set of polarities sun moon, but it also has this suggestion of force, and that comfort with the element of violence is also something you see coming out of populist culture in a certain form at a certain in actual physical encounter with violence. We often associate boxing, we associate karate and that sort of thing with elements of lowbrow culture. So physical practices in yoga and kind of naturally have a relationship to that field.
So tell me about your doctoral thesis. What are you studying now?
My doctoral thesis is on the history of yoga in America. And it begins at about the point of 1890 when a Swami by the name of Vivekananda came to America. There were certain developments in Hindu culture at that time which mirrored things that were happening in our culture at the time. We might say there was an avant-garde of religion. You had this group called the Brahmo Samaj that Vivekananda came out of. He was a bridge figure. He was schooled in Western forms, but he came out of Hindu culture. He was in an Eastern culture, but he was confronting Western culture at a time when Western culture was oppressing Eastern culture in a huge way. The British had been running India since like the mid-1700s, and their control over that culture was deepening. At the same time, there was a way in which the Hindus were confronted by and challenged by British culture and stimulated by British culture. You had the Hindu Renaissance happening in the early 1800s, and Vivekananda owes his development of thought and spirit to that movement. That movement was in dialogue with elements in the West, the Unitarians, Emerson, Whitman, the Transcendentalists. And if we think about those figures, they're figures who we look on as enlightened. It's not evangelical culture. It's not Orthodox culture. It's an emerging culture that's challenging norms. And so as Vivekananda came into this culture, presenting ideas about yoga, presenting ideas around Hindu culture, certain elements of this culture started to gravitate to them. They already were gravitating to them. The Bhagavad Gita had been translated in 1795 and was being read. As everybody knows, Emerson was a great fan of the Gita. In Boston, there were Buddhist groups. The Theosophists had started around 1870, who were kind of pushing the other direction, moving into India with ideas from the West and then translating them for the West. They published a lot of early texts, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika and the Yoga Sutras. Vivekananda himself translated the sutras for an American audience using the idiom of America. This is the age of Horatio Alger and robber barons and a strong kind of polarity in the cultures socioeconomically. You had the Great Depression of 1893 and muckrakers and that sort of thing attempting to break up the trusts that were running this culture economically. So you had these intense dialogues going on in the culture, and Vivekananda stepped in kind of appealing to highbrow people who were have that freedom to kind of explore another culture. He was bankrolled by a lot of rich widows and whatnot. But he brought these ideas about Hindu culture into a country that was experiencing a lot of ferment. Ideas were being challenged around religion because of Darwinism and Nietzsche and that sort of thing. The whole idea that God is dead or that we're just creatures of biology and not divine creatures. And so he stepped into that with a new kind of synthesis. That's kind of the beauty of Hindu culture. It doesn't sweep away science. It has no beef with science, whereas Orthodox religious cultures in the West often do. We see that as a separation. So that integration, the way he offered that integration to the West, was appealing to people. Not at first to everybody, of course, but it eventually gained momentum. And if you read Vivekananda ideas today, they seem very up to date, because this New Age culture has been prevalent since the 60s, and we're all familiar with its forms, whether you're aligned with it or not.
And what about with Tantra? How widely embraced is that becoming?
In America?
Yeah.
Well, I think there's like little sects, S-E-C-T-S, that are interested in Tantra. Neo-Tantra is huge in the Bay Area. If you put Tantra in a Google search, you get all these websites. Many of them are in San Francisco, and they have thousands of members. I think the West has a problematic relationship to sex, and I think Tantra offers an opportunity to explore that in a certain frame that perhaps makes it safe, or perhaps provides a template for some new forms that might be more satisfying, ways to understand it, ways to embrace it. You have Kali Ma here in the Bay Area. You have Guru Maichidla Sananda, who has runs the Siddha Foundation, and those are Guru Pampara traditions. Those are traditions that are rooted in the Tantra tradition, Kashmir Shaivism in India. I think Kali Ma actually comes out of a Buddhist tradition, but there's also a long tradition of Buddhist Tantra. But so you have those forms side by side, and I know that you guys have hosted Kali Ma, so there's a resonance there that you guys share. Mm-hmm. One is not rooted in the old tradition in India. It's sort of looking at it from afar and admiring its forms and then adapting them willy-nilly. And then you have this other tradition which is deeply rooted in that, but it's adapted to a Western context. I mean, if you look at what Guru Mai is doing, I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, she's adapted to Western culture big time. They've got the whole media machine running, and they're doing a great job.
Thanks for listening to A Taste of Sex. We've been talking to Eric Shaw, and you can visit his website at prasanayoga.com. That's prasanayoga.com. This show is produced by One Taste. Check out our other podcasts on personallifemedia.com. If you have any questions or comments about the show, we'd love to hear from you. Please post to our online chat board at onetaste.us. You'll find calendars for our San Francisco and New York centers both online. Check out some of our upcoming workshops and classes. Thanks so much.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.